Hi friends, it's Brittany. Before we dive into today's episode, I have a quick ask for you. I need your help. I'm doing a short listener survey to get to know you a little bit better. Who's tuning in? What do you love? And how I can keep Conscious Pathways fresh, meaningful, and aligned with what you need. It won't take more than 5 minutes, and your feedback means so much to me. It helps me grow and helps this podcast to grow with you. You'll find the link in the show notes, and I would be so grateful if you took a moment to share your thoughts. Thanks for being here. Thanks for listening. And now let's get into the episode.
I just want to acknowledge that we are living in strange times. And so it's okay to be afraid of getting it wrong. Folks, oftentimes, I talk with teachers a lot, and they oftentimes talk about how, like, well, I don't want to talk about these topics because X, Y, and Z. But the first thing they say is, I don't want to get it wrong. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say something that's incorrect. But to me, getting it wrong is not the worst thing, but refusing to try is. Yes. What matters is a humility, and that folks should recognize and have a willingness to learn, but also having a commitment to centering, like, the humanity of those whose histories we're teaching.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Conscious Pathways, the podcast where we explore the intersection of education and social justice with curiosity, care, and intention. Today's episode is one I know many of you will deeply connect with. I'm joined by Dr. Brittany Jones, an educator, scholar, and former secondary social studies teacher whose work centers on anti-racist history education and emotional literacy. In this conversation, we talk honestly about the fear many educators fear. We talk honestly about the fear many educators feel when it comes to teaching hard histories, especially in today's political climate. Brittany shares how her personal and professional journey led her to explore ways in which emotions are treated in the classroom, especially in racialized emotions like Black anger, and how that impacts both teaching and learning. In our conversation, we dig into what it means to teach accurate history with empathy, how traditional schooling often disconnects us from our emotions, and why bringing emotions into our curriculum isn't a distraction from learning, but it's an act of liberation. So whether you're a teacher, a parent, or someone reflecting on our own educational experiences, I know this episode will spark something in you. So let's get into it. Hi, and welcome to Conscious Pathways. Today I am joined by Brittany Jones. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
We were just giggling and chatting about having the same name.
Right. And all the forms of spelling.
All the many forms. We have A-N-Y, we have N-E-Y. I've seen one with an I-E, one T, two T. Growing up, I had a friend named Christina. So, you know, we had the Britney Spears and the Christina Aguilera. And that was during the time. Yeah. So we felt special.
Right. I feel seen.
Yes. It's like we are ruling the whole elementary school. But to get us started, can you tell me a little bit about how you got your start in education?
Yes. So I like to say I got my start in education as a young child because both my parents were teachers, elementary school teachers. So for me, I always wondered, like, how come my friends have a summer, but I don't? Because my parents are teaching me in the summer, so I'm going to school year round. So that I like to say that's my first start in education. But really, I think my first formal start in education happened, I think, when I was finishing my master's degree in history. And my very last class was I had to take a how to teach history class, and that was in the College of Ed. It was about history and historical consciousness. That class just really got me excited about the ways in which history can be transformed for K through 12 students. So I ended up going back to school, long story short, and earned my master's degree in teaching and started teaching from there and absolutely loved it.
Yes. I feel similarly. Once I got in the classroom and started teaching, I was like, oh no, this is it. This is what I like.
Yeah.
And, you know, teaching history is, I mean, obviously teaching all of the subjects is really important, but especially in this day and age right now, teaching history and teaching the accurate history of what actually happened and all of those great things is so important. And it's definitely something that's under attack this day and age. We need history and social studies teachers more than ever. I know a lot of your research into history and a lot of your research kind of deals with the kind of emotional aspect of it and the racialized emotions of it. Can you talk a little bit more to that?
Mm-hmm. I can. Yeah. So somehow became really, really interested in the power and impact of emotions. And part of this was, I'll never forget, summer 2020. And I kept hearing about, you know, George Floyd, and his murderer had his knee on his neck, and folks were justifying it with, oh, he's scared. That's why he had to maintain his knee being on his neck, despite, you know, George Floyd incessantly crying out for his mother. And I thought about the ways in which the murderer's fear was operationalized and weaponized in a way that kind of justified the death of George Floyd. And then I started to think more about history, particularly Black histories, and the ways in which emotions have been weaponized and justified to, you know, inflict violence and harm on Black bodies. I think about Emmett Till, right, and the way in which his whistle might have feared a white woman if the whistle really happened, right, which led to his death. I think about the fear that enslavers had of enslaved rebellions, right, and that literally led to a codification of harsher fugitive slave laws into law, right? Emotions are powerful, and they impact history, and they transform history. And centering the power of emotions in our history curriculum is incredibly important, but often overlooked when we teach and when we prepare teachers to teach history.
Yes, yes, yes. And you do bring up that really good point of like centering those emotions, right? Because whose emotions are we actually centering? Because there were a lot of emotions and a lot of feelings and ideas that were coming up, especially after George Floyd and learning about Emmett Till and all these things that have happened throughout history. But, you know, whose thoughts and emotions are really being centered in this story is a really important aspect that you're kind of focusing on. You bring up a point about neutrality and objectivity, right? And how that becomes kind of part of our education system, right? Trying to, you know, we're going to be neutral to this. We're going to be objective to this, right? But we're not really centering in the thoughts and emotions of, you know, who's actually being harmed, right? And that's a big part of, you know, when we think about restorative justice, centering harm and centering community is a really big aspect of that. And so how do you think, you know, having neutrality, how do you think that contributes to in classroom?
I feel like when you have neutrality, you also negate talking about someone's emotions, right? To say that you want to teach in ways that are neutral, you're omitting the ways in which people felt in the past and how those feelings impacted the present and subsequently will impact the future. People feel, and it shows up in so many primary sources that we discuss and use with our students. When we don't talk about the ways in which someone felt and how that informed their response to an action, we're leaving out a very humanizing part of the past. One of the things that make us most human are our emotions. But if we teach as if events that happened in the past and the present didn't inform how we feel, we're teaching in ways that don't capture the entire past and, to our question earlier, the truthful past.
You know, something that's really coming up for me in this conversation is how emotions, especially in the Black communities, are either suppressed or weaponized. And we hear messages like, don't cry, be a big kid, or we even see tropes like the angry Black woman, which is really used to invalidate real, justified emotions like anger. And yet emotions are such a central part of what makes us human. There's no such thing as a bad emotion. It's just what we do with them that actually matters. And so I'm so curious, in your own research, how do you see emotions being repressed, validated, or even distorted in educational spaces? And how does that emotional dynamic show up in the teaching and learning of history?
Yeah, that's a good question. So a study I did maybe 3 years ago, it was looking at the emotion of fear in Virginia's U.S. history curriculum framework. And I was just interested really in who was able to fear in the standards. And so through my perusal of the U.S. history standards, I found that white folks were the only people who were described as being able to fear, right? And so it was very interesting because I also looked at how many times instances of Black suffering were mentioned in the standards. So thinking about enslavement, references to enslavement, Jim Crow, segregation, lynchings, all these things that would incorporate Black suffering. And it showed up over 100 times, those words in the standards, but never one time were Black people able to experience fear. Only white folks. It was only attributed to white folks. And so to me, this is very interesting because the construction of this sentence, when white folks were able to fear, it literally always justified harm of the historicized other. So when you ask about what emotions are suppressed, right, people of colors, but specifically Black people's emotions are oftentimes always suppressed, and white fear is often always highlighted. And while folks may not say that, or educators may not say what I just said explicitly to their students, when students only learn about white fear as justification of harm, you know, it does something to the psyche, mm-hmm. right? Like, people can suffer, but they can't feel.
Yeah.
So what does that mean? It dehumanizes folks, right? I can experience all this pain, but I don't feel anything from it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think a shift needs to happen where if we are comfortable enough to talk about Black suffering, we have to be comfortable enough to talk about the ways in which that suffering made Black folks feel. I think that can radically shift the ways in which students, particularly Black students, are seen or feel seen in classrooms when they're able to see how folks feared, how folks were angry, how folks were sad, how folks were happy. They can also kind of better understand the feelings that they feel when they experience anti-Blackness in society, right? This is not something that's just current. Like, folks been feeling this way, but we don't talk about it enough. And my other little, this might be a hot take, so lucky you for your podcast.
Yes.
We talk a lot about Black joy, and Black joy is great. Mm-hmm. I love it.
Yes.
But we cannot just only talk about Black joy, because the reality is people have felt so, Black folks have felt so many other things outside of joy mm-hmm. throughout history and in the present. So what does it mean to talk about Black joy and Black fear and Black rage and Black sadness? This is where my work is and what I'm looking at and the ways in which emotions do and don't show up and how they're weaponized.
Ooh, I got chills. I just got chills. I was like, oh, dang, girl. Just dropping truth knowledge everywhere. Because that is such an excellent point. I am pro your hot take here, because that is really important, right? I also agree. I love the Black joy that we're seeing, and I see it like Black boy joy. And I'm like, yes, I see that. I love that. I want to see Black kids being able to experience joy and have joyful moments. But just as I was mentioning before, we're also allowed to feel the full breadth of all of our emotions, right? And then, you know, when we're just kind of locked into one of these boxes of you're resilient and you're strong and you're happy, then it's like, when I feel something wrong with me, right?
Exactly.
Am I the outsider? Am I the weird one who's like, hey, this doesn't feel right? And I know, like, for me growing up, that was me 100%, right? I was just a very deeply feeling child, a very sensitive child. I felt things very deeply, and I would cry about things. And, you know, as my family, like, oh, she's just so sensitive, or blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, it just kind of made me try to harden up a little bit, because I was like, oh, well, I don't want to be the sensitive one, right? But, mm-hmm. you know, there's so much beauty in that, and being able to feel and being super empathetic and being able to see how other people are feeling. And I think that that lends itself into this mental health epidemic, pandemic, whatever it is that we're in right now, especially within the Black and Brown community. Our pain and our sadness and our sorrow isn't really seen. And then we have to suffer through this alone. And that can go into higher rates of suicide, higher rates of self-harm, right? All of these different ways in which it comes out, you know, chronic pain, right? The body will keep the score. It'll tell you, right? Whether you're listening, or it'll tell you inside first. It's like, you're not listening to me. Okay.
Yep.
Then your knee's gonna hurt today.
Yeah, you're gonna feel it.
You know, I'm tired, you're gonna lay down. Either you're gonna do it on your own, or I'm gonna make you.
That's right.
You know, and just the ways in which Black and Brown people just have to push through these, and how that takes a toll, right? All out is going to take a toll in your work life, in your family life. It's going to take a toll in the way that you're able to show up within your family, within your social life, with your friends, right? All of that kind of takes that toll. And it reminds me a lot of what my great colleague, Dr. AJ Lyons, talks about is racial battle fatigue. That impacts you, right? The effects of racism and the effects of all of these different things that happen in our lives, and how that will kind of lead to these really deep wounds that if we're not taking care of, it becomes this thing that is like PTSD from racism, right? And it's rough. It really does take a toll on our bodies and our minds and our souls. So yes.
It does. Yes. It really does.
Yeah. So in terms of your work, what have you seen, like what strategies have you seen work in classrooms in terms of highlighting these issues and bringing them to students' attention and supporting educators?
Yeah, that's another great question. I haven't seen that much work because this idea of centering emotions is new. You spoke to how focusing on social emotional learning is a newer trend that we're seeing in education now. And I think that one of the reasons for that is that sometimes emotions are pitted as opposite of rational cognitive thinking, when actually they're complementary. So being emotionally supportive within our classrooms really doesn't mean shielding students from teaching about, you know, the violent or oppressive truths of our past, but it means to attending to how those truths are taught and received and how they made folks feel. When we start to think about what a pedagogy of emotion or critical emotion might look like in our classrooms, it might start with, I've actually started doing this in my own practice with just people when you see them. You know, oftentimes when we see people and we're like, how are you doing?
Yeah.
And I've tried to like switch that discourse to how are you feeling? Yeah. You get different answers. I think it's more humanizing and a little bit more intimate to ask someone how they're feeling as opposed to how you're doing. And so in classrooms, I've done professional developments where I've urged teachers to start with, how are you all feeling today? And then throughout the lesson, as they're teaching, asking folks or asking their students, how does learning that make you feel? And I think for students, it really presents an opportunity for them to share how their feeling informs their sense making, because they're not separate. Like how we feel informs how we think, and how we make sense of the things that we're learning. So using pedagogies that really center and incorporate emotions is something that I've been thinking a lot about what that looks like. It's a wide range of what that could look like. But I think critically and thoughtfully incorporating emotions and checking in to our own like students' well-being as part of instruction is a good first step and a necessary step.
Yes, yeah. I absolutely agree. And I love the idea of shifting from, you know, how are you doing to how are you feeling today? Because that is, it's an important question. And I think one thing that I've been kind of doing, and I know some educators have been doing in their classrooms as well, is kind of enhancing the vocabulary for students. We don't talk about emotions enough. We don't talk about the breadth of emotions, right? There's more emotions than just good, happy, fine, mad, sad, right?
Right.
There's so many more emotions. I'm ecstatic. I'm depressed. Yes. So many different ways that you can describe that, and they mean different things. And trying to just add to students' vocabulary, their big thing to be able to do that, you know, being able to share exactly how you're feeling and know that there's language for that. When I learn that there's a word for something that, like, well, you have a word for that?
I know. That's why I love the movie Inside Out, right?
Oh, yeah.
I think that's such a great movie, one and two, because it gives like kids, are the little humans, such a vocabulary for what they're feeling, like ennui.
Yes.
I know what that means now because I feel it and I saw that movie.
Yes. Like being able to explain that and having one word that explains and really encapsulates all of the different ways that you can feel and all those great things. I don't know what it's called, but I have Brené Brown's latest book where she goes through each of the emotions. It's a very beautiful book, the physical version of it. Kind of see all the images and talks about all these different, like, what does wonder mean? What does nostalgia mean when you feel nostalgic? Like, what does that actually mean? It's really fascinating. See, that standpoint,
right.
Like what are they? How do we feel them? What is this? And
yeah.
You know, especially in a world and a society where capitalism is just taken hold, you know, we get into this you know, very like grind mentality, and we kind of forget that at the core of it we're people with feelings and ideas. And you know, when we actually lean into that, it allows us to be more creative and more happy and more free, right? But it is work that we have to do. It's not easy.
That's right. Yeah, and it doesn't come naturally, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So yeah, it is something we have to be intentional about.
Exactly. Intentional in our practices. The more regressive shifts that we've made in education, I was feeling really excited when we started seeing social emotional learning coming to the forefront, talking about it. And now it's kind of been attacked as kind of DEI wokeness, which I don't know how social emotional learning got grouped into that, but struggling to still make this work within their classrooms without, you know, being attacked, right? Or kind of being constrained, being constantly constrained by the different standards and being constrained by administrations and things. What advice would you give to, you know, educators or parents who want to do this work but might be a little bit more constrained with what they can actually do in the classroom?
Yeah, so I just want to acknowledge, right, that we are living in strange times. And so it is, you know, it's okay to, you know, be afraid of getting it wrong, right? Because, again, because we're talking about emotions, right? Like, fear is natural. Mm-hmm. But I would push back and say that silence or avoidance of teaching history accurately and truthfully is not the answer, and it's harmful. Folks, oftentimes, I talk with teachers a lot, and they oftentimes talk about how, like, well, I don't want to talk about these topics because X, Y, and Z. But the first thing they say is, I don't want to get it wrong. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say something that's incorrect. But to me, getting it wrong is not the worst thing, but refusing to try is. Yes. What matters is a humility, and that folks should recognize and have a willingness to learn. Mm-hmm. But also having a commitment to centering, like, the humanity of those whose histories we're teaching or that they're teaching. So I think that if you put humanity first, it's hard to have backlash because I'm talking about one's humanity, right? That's where I'm coming from. Talking about humanity, you can then talk about somebody's emotions, right? And then this is a good way, talking about how folks felt after experiencing a historical event is a good way to talk about all these words that folks are trying to get educators not to say, like racism or white supremacy, even though it's clearly in our past, present.
Yeah.
So I think mistakes can be repaired, but avoidance can't. When you build trust with students, asking them how they feel, how this makes you feel, and show care, and when you lean into community, listening to those who are most affected, you can become more equipped and you can feel less reticent teaching these histories that folks are trying to prohibit and ban from our schools.
Yes, yes, yes. I felt that. I felt everything you said in my heart and soul. I was like, preach, yes. Because you're so right. That avoidance component of it, like you said, we can repair mistakes, right? If you're trying, you're going on a limb, you're trying something new, and maybe that's not working. Maybe you've made some mistakes. Maybe you've got something wrong. That can always be repaired, right? And an apology goes a long way. Hey, I misspoke. People are often more forgiving than we give them credit for, right? As long as we take accountability, right, for our actions and apologize and move forward. But our silence, right? You know, your silence is, your inaction is still an action, right? Silence is still, it's still a choice. Like, you're still making a choice to be silent, especially in times like this. And, you know, it's hard, but it's a brave choice, you know? And I always say, I think teaching is a political act, right? So being in front of the classroom, being in front of students, being in front of the next generation of adults, right? It's a political act, and it's a responsibility that you have. And I think we all, you know, similar to how doctors have a Hippocratic oath to do no harm, ethical responsibility to not do harm.
Absolutely.
In a lot of ways, silence is harmful. Teaching accurate history is harmful. Not ringing up these stories and not, you know, being honest and truthful about, you know, what has happened, how we got there, it is harmful at the end of the day. And I know my audience is tired of me talking about systems of oppression, but I will never stop talking about systems of oppression.
No, because they're always here.
They're always there. They're here. Might as well just rename the podcast Systems of Oppression. Get back on my soapbox about this, but they are there. And those ideologies are shaped by the ideas that we have as a society. And if we can control that narrative, if we can control the history that people know, that's part of feeding into the ideologies that everyone then buys into, and that seeps into our institutions and it seeps into our interpersonal relationships, right? And so just knowing that we have that obligation to be as honest and truthful as we can. Mm-hmm. It's important and it's worthy work, right? And
it is.
It's worthy work. And as long as you reach out to your community, reach out to people, like we're not in this alone, right? There's so many educators out here who are in the same boat, who are saying we want to do our best for our students and we want to make sure that they are getting an accurate education, right? And being a part of that means that we need to kind of do our own research and do our own kind of work as a community to come together and make sure that we're doing the best for our students.
Very true.
It's so hard out here.
The moment we're in is not the only moment that this has happened, right? This has happened before. And folks have pushed through, pushed back against those moments. So this is just another iteration, right? To your point about folks trying to suppress the truth. Yeah. That's just a mechanism for trying to keep power. History taught us.
Yeah, I know. History has a way of repeating itself, unfortunately. So, at least we can see it. I'm like, I know what you're doing. Every news story that comes out, I'm like, I know what you're doing. Stop it.
Right.
Like, you're not slick. Tell me a little bit about what a liberatory social studies, what does that look and feel like in a classroom to you?
So, obviously, as we've talked about this time, like, I think emotions is liberating. Because I like to think, well, I don't like to think in opposites, but in this case, I will. And so to not have liberty, right, is to try to restrain how people feel so that they don't feel they're kind of just like robots. And so a liberatory education would be able to allow folks to feel. And so, you know, I like to ask people to think about how approaches for liberation, and I'm talking, you know, specifically through a social studies history mindset, how people felt when they did not feel free or they did not feel like they had liberty. And, you know, so I like to think of this quote. I'm from Virginia, Richmond specifically, and there is an enslaved man, his name is Gabriel Prosser, and he set up and ran an enslaved rebellion before Nat Turner. So his rebellion was in 1801, and it was thwarted. It wasn't really able to get off the ground. But anyways, before they were about to lynch him, he said, I tried to give liberty, but you all gave me death. And, you know, he's pushing back on that famous quote from Patrick Henry who said, give me liberty or give me death for the Revolutionary War. And Prosser's like, I tried to get liberty, but y'all gave me death. And I like to think about that a lot when we think about education writ large. Students express their emotions in classrooms, in schools, in a multitude of ways. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes, Black and brown kids, the ways in which they express their emotions are seen as disruptive, and they become over-disciplined for just being, right, and feeling. So for me, a liberatory education starts with being able to accept and learn more about the feelings and emotions that are expressed by students in classrooms and thinking about what it means to be emotionally literate. I don't think we can have liberty if folks can't feel first. And so that's why, you know, really centering emotions in all aspects of schools and pedagogy for me is really important, because if we want students to feel comfortable enough, right, to want to be in your classroom and learn, we have to make sure that we're creating classroom environments where students feel like they can be, simply be, right?
Yes, yes, yes. And I wholeheartedly agree. I think classrooms that feel liberated and have liberatory qualities to it, have classrooms where students are free to feel, right? Where they can cry without judgment, right? They can express without judgment. You know, I have been in very few classrooms where I felt like it wouldn't be like, why is she doing that? Right? Like, there's probably like one or two classes I've ever had in my entire life where it's like, I felt that comfortable, or, you know, like if I did cry, I knew that it would be kind of surrounded by people who were like, yeah, we're there. We're right there with you. Yep. This is hard information. And You know, especially when we're learning about history and learning about hard things, right? Mm-hmm. It's a set aside from it, right? Usually you're just kind of teaching, it's kind of like this kind of, it just feels blasé, like, then we enslaved people and then we didn't enslave people, yeah. You know? And that history is such a short period of time in the context of a classroom, right? When we're teaching it, I learned way more about so many other things than I ever did about slavery, about Jim Crow, about the civil rights movement, about the Black Panther movement. Those things, like, that was kind of in like 28 days, I got to learn about those once a year, mm-hmm. got to learn about it. And I remember it feeling really hard and difficult, like reading these really brutal things that other people did to other people. It was just like I was reading, you know, a children's book or something, just like, and then this happened,
right?
Next page, right?
Yep.
And, you know, just leaving that classroom and just having to sit with that, right? Mm-hmm. And especially being a Black woman, leaving the classroom and having to sit with that. I don't know who my ancestors are because of slavery, right? Like, I don't know where my ancestors come from because of slavery, right? And knowing that this was my ancestors that this happened to, right? And that's a hard thing to just sit with, mm-hmm. and just be like, huh.
Yep.
You know,
yeah.
I'm here, but there's millions of people who also should be here who just aren't here.
Right.
And
it's amazing that I'm even here then.
Yeah.
Right?
When you really think about it, when you see the mass of what happened, right? Like, it over years, timelines just stopped existing at certain points, right?
Yep.
And having to sit with that, know where to put that, you know, just like, okay, I know this now. Now, what do I do with this information? Just as stories of Black joy are important, as stories of the resilience are important, it's also important for us to know that there was also a lot of pain. From the beautiful art that was created and from the beauty that came out of that, there was a lot of pain. And just trying to think of how classrooms would feel if we just took a moment to, even if you just took a moment in your classroom to just pause. Like, hey, we just read some, right? Yep. Like, it's okay. Whatever you're feeling about it right now is very okay. You know, mm-hmm. I'm just trying to think.
And that, to your point, like, I think that this is really important for Black students and mm-hmm. students of color. But this is also really important for white students, right? Because to your point, right, the suffering mm-hmm. that we learn about becomes a blip when we're teaching. Mm-hmm. But imagine asking, you know, a white student to look at this source and then look for the emotions that these people felt. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? Asking them, do you think that, you know, marginalized groups, people of color, intentionally marginalized people still feel these emotions today? Why or why not? And this is where we like move from just rote memorization mm-hmm. to really thinking critically about, you know, continuity and change and how the past informs the present. It also gets white students who will never be able to experience or feel like anti-Blackness. They'll never be able to feel this type of racism that we're speaking to, mm. to start thinking more deeply about how violence and trauma may make people feel. And the goal is to then have them think about, well, what can I do in my day-to-day own personal life so that people don't feel these things in the present? Talking about emotions is humanizing, but talking about emotions should also be things that turn into action. This work is necessary and useful work. And the other thing is that folks can say, well, kids are too young to talk about this. No, right? Because kids are probably the best people to talk about their emotions. Like, they know when they're upset. Yes. They know when they're mad. They know when other people feel upset and mad mm-hmm. and happy and all those other things. So, no, talking about feelings is a good starting point to be critical at early ages. Yeah. Start thinking about, I don't want my classmate to feel this way anymore. So what can I do to be better? So it's all about what can we do to make the next day, the next year, the next 10 years, the future, mm-hmm. a place where folks don't have to feel injustice, pain.
Yes, 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 yes. And I feel like, you know, if we focused on emotions, if we focused on the, because, right, as you said, the emotions, they humanize us, right? They bring that back because, you know, a lot of, again, going back to systems of oppression, but we go back to the idea, the purpose of it is to dehumanize, is to separate the human from, we can do whatever we want because they're not real people, right? You see it even in media today, talk about immigration, right? The verbiage that is used is intentional to dehumanize you know, people who are immigrating to this country, who are trying to seek refuge, who are trying to come find better for their families, right? And the language that we use is dehumanizing. If we stop for a moment and we think, what are these people feeling, right? Because it takes a lot. It takes a lot for someone to leave their home of origin, right? They've set down roots where their family lives. It takes a lot for a person to make the choice to leave that, right? It's not an easy choice. It's not something that just wake up overnight like, you know what? I think I'm going to go cross the border today. No. Right? Like, this isn't an easy choice, and it's not an easy pathway to get there. And so when we sit down, we actually humanize that choice of, that must be a really difficult choice to go to a country where you don't know anyone. You probably don't know the language. You don't know the customs. Yep. The weather might be different. The people are different. The food is different. And I think a lot of our issues that we see today, and if we came back to, people are making hard choices. People are making hard choices to stay alive. People are making hard choices for their families. And how can we humanize that? And how can we see that humanity in it? And I think no one's saying focusing on emotions and talking about emotions is easy, right? We've been trained for many, many years to not do that. And especially in the classroom, you know, those students have been trained many, many years to not talk about these things, that talking about your emotions makes you somehow, you know, feminine, makes you a girl, makes you a baby.
Right.
And it's like, even for women to feel their emotions, right? It's like, oh, she's just being a woman.
Yeah.
But we all have the capacity to feel. Why is this? Why have we genderized feeling?
I know.
That's a whole other conversation.
It really is.
That's a whole other episode right there. But it's just, when you take that time and just humanize the things, I think a lot of our issues today would probably start to go away if we just humanized. We got back to being, it's wild.
Yeah. I agree. And I mean, you know, and folks talk about like, oh, dehumanization, humanity, centering it. Mm-hmm. They like talk about these things a lot. But I mean, even when you're talking about it, it really just gives me a moment of pause to really think like, yes, like, why don't we treat folks like humans? Mm-hmm. And what a different world we would be if we did. So absolutely.
Yes. And on that note, how do you reimagine education?
Yeah. So I feel like if we took seriously emotions as part of education, you know, I think we might see a shift from performative diversity to, you know, transformative inclusion. Classrooms writ large, we might no longer treat Black students, students of color, or any students' emotions kind of like as disruptions, but as critical knowledge. What can we learn from why folks are feeling this way in my particular class? You know, curriculum would change. Thinking about emotions as part of curriculum would engage so many histories and would engage so many students in so many ways, right? Assessment would be different. It would include reflection and expression of how one feels, not just like their recall. And I think how we train teachers would also be different, not only in the content that we teach them, but in how to engage in, you know, emotional responsiveness and cultural, you know, humility. I write a lot about racialized emotions, so like the ways in which race and emotions kind of intersect and how that informs our responses, particularly given that we live in a racialized hierarchical society. So people don't feel the same as other folks, right? And so understanding that point and making sure that's included into our instruction, our curriculum, our pedagogy would be a necessary shift in humanizing schooling writ large.
I loved the breakdown of how that would feel at every single level. Because it's so true. At every single level, if there was just that one change, right, in the curriculum, in the classroom, in the way that we approach even discipline, right? I always say that behaviors communication, like that's what it is in the day. They're communicating something to you. And it's part of our job as the adult in the room and the educator, right, to use our usually fully formed brain to think about, what is this behavior communicating to me? What is the deeper need that they're actually trying to tell me right now that I might not be seeing? And sometimes that's a basic human need. Maybe, you know, it's, I literally just need to eat.
Right.
You know, maybe it's a sensory need. Like, it is too loud. It is too bright. It is too much in here. And maybe it's an emotional need. I am experiencing a lot of feelings right now. right? And that's a form, that's a communication, right? And so what is this student? What is this individual communicating? And I do that with myself sometimes too. I'll be like, my mind is like going all like, okay, what is being communicated right now?
Right. That's exactly right. And I feel like teachers may be like, I don't know, I'm not equipped to be able to do that. And that's okay too. Like we talked about earlier, it's okay. But I think not acknowledging one's emotions and not ignoring it is not the right path. That's the wrong path. So it's okay to be like, I don't know what to do because you're feeling this way, but I acknowledge that you are. Mm-hmm. And so what can we do, you know, to move forward is useful.
It is so useful. And again, giving students the tools, you know, giving them you know, the tools of either it's language, maybe it's imagery, right? Maybe it's an art project that we do just to start expressing, like get the emotion somewhere that we can see it. You know, there's so many different ways that we can do that and we can work with students and help them to put their emotions somewhere, right? Because when you're just sitting with it, that's when we start getting those maladaptive behaviors, right? Because it's like, I feel so much and I don't know what to do with that. And, you know, we can all learn together. Like you said, I don't know how to help you with that, but let's figure it out together. Right.
Yeah.
I think sometimes when we're, you know, the teachers in the classroom, we feel like we have to be the all knowing, omnipotent being that knows everything and has all the answers. And it's like, no, you're just a person.
Yeah.
I'm a person. You're a person. Students are people. Like, we're all just people. Right. We're all just trying to figure things out.
That's exactly right.
That was my biggest learning of coming into my 30s and being adult was just like, oh, okay, so we all don't know what we're doing. Okay, cool. Yep. We're all just out here doing stuff.
That's right.
That feels better.
Let's go with it.
I thought I would turn 30 and just like, oh, there you go. I've been passed upon the baton of knowing what I'm doing now. That's great. No, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just doing stuff.
Right.
I'm just here.
I'm trying to make it.
Where can my audience find you?
Yes, you can follow me on X, is what we're calling it.
I think I used it once, and I was like, that's enough of that.
A account, Brittany Jones on LinkedIn. Yeah, I think those are my only two socials. So, of course, you can always email me, too, at bjones4@buffalo.edu.
Sounds perfect. I'll link all of that in the show notes below. Brittany, I want to thank you so much for joining me and to sharing all of your knowledge and just dropping so many beautiful truth bombs. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
I hope this conversation with Dr. Brittany Jones gave you something to sit with, reflect on, and carry into your own spaces, whether it's in the classroom, a dinner table, or your very own community. If there's one big takeaway from this episode, it's that emotions belong in education. Our histories are deeply emotional, especially for Black students and families, and acknowledging that is a part of creating learning environments that are both truthful and humanizing. As always, thank you so much for being a part of this journey with me. If this episode resonated with you, please share it with a fellow educator or parent. And don't forget to subscribe, leave a rating or review, and check out the show notes for more resources. Until next time, stay curious, stay grounded, and keep walking the conscious path. And I'll see you next time for more transformative conversations. Bye! If you're like me, you believe in the power of education and social justice. And what's more powerful than a good book? Today, I want to share an incredible way for you to support local independent bookstores while you indulge in your love of reading. Have you ever heard of bookshop.org? They're an amazing platform that connects readers just like us to independent booksellers all around the world. Local bookstores are essential for our communities. They foster culture, curiosity, and a lifelong love of reading. But they need our support to thrive, especially in this age of e-commerce giants. Bookshop.org is committed to helping those bookstores flourish. Every purchase you make on their site financially supports independent bookstores. That's right, every single purchase. They provide these stores with the tools they need to compete online and maintain their vibrant presence in our neighborhoods. They put their mission and public good above financial interests, giving over 80% of their profit margin to independent bookstores. That's a commitment you don't see every day. In fact, in 2020, they were recognized as the best of the world by B Labs, ranking in the top 5% of all B corporations. And guess what? It's written into their government's documents that they will never sell the company to Amazon or any major retailer. That's dedication to their mission. Plus, as a climate-neutral company, they're committed to operating sustainably, another reason to feel good about your purchases. So if you're looking to buy a book and make a positive impact, head over to bookshop.org and use my affiliate link that's linked in my show notes below. By doing so, you'll be supporting local bookshops and helping them thrive.
Let's make a difference one book at a time. Happy reading, and thank you for supporting our local bookshops.